It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
We need a lot more farmers in this country, and we've heard some of the numbers before. There's the average age is like 62 now in this country. They're not getting any younger, and there's a lot of people that want to become farmers but need help. Well, so we need a crop of farmers. Well, I'm talking to a farmer of farmers right now. My guest is Tim Young, and Tim, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Thanks, Roger. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Tim, you have created something called the Small Farm Nation Academy, and I kind of do the shortcut on this. We've talked before, and I've looked at what you've got online, and it looks to me that you are really working at trying to help us solve that problem of getting more farmers out there. And to do that, the farmers have to be profitable to be able to, one, get started, two, actually market themselves and have a viable entity so that they're not just kind of scraping by, making the equivalent of $4 an hour for all their work, that it's profitable enough for them to have follow a passion.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a very good way to think about it. I mean, when I opted out of the rat race, 12, 13 years ago, and became a farmer and started with 120 acres and, raised grass-fed beef, pastured poultry, woodlot pork. We milked cows, we made artisan cheese, and we did all these things that a lot of people do and want to do. But one of the things that surprised me was that, in my experience at least, Roger, successful small-scale farming was about 20% about growing and 80% about marketing. And so what I've learned is that I wasn't the only one to come to that realization. A lot of people, whether they come from a long farming background or whether they left another job to start a farm, they are drawn to the idyllic side of farming, the pastoral landscapes, getting their hands dirty, having the livestock or whatever. But they quickly learn, I've got to sell this product that I produce in the land. Otherwise, I am not going to be sustainable. So what the Small Farm Nation Academy is all about is it's about teaching all the disciplines and skills necessary to be a great marketer so that the small farmer can be successful.
You know, it's interesting that you point that out, because I think for many people, they do view it as a way of life, and that's initially what a lot of the attraction is. And that's been a battle, because it seemed like back, 30, 40 years ago, we started talking about industrialization in a positive way, that they had to get, crank out large scale, lots and lots of, work on yield, work on, mass production of commodities. And you had people then that included some of the secretaries of agriculture that were making them feel bad for liking it as a way of life. And so for a while, the mantra was to go out and say, oh, no, it's not a way of life. This is a business. We're just the same as any other business that's trying to get larger and make a lot of money. And the nuance,
right?
Here,
the mantra back then was fence row to fence row.
Well, that's right. That's right. And so when I hear you saying, on the one hand, you're acknowledging that people are into it for all these other reasons, too. I mean, they love it. They want to be their own boss. They want to be outside. They want to feel the satisfaction, in some cases, of getting their hands in the dirt or taking care of animals. And all those things are good. But all of those things can be balanced with what you're telling them is that you still have to have a bottom line. It has to be a business. And you don't have to choose that you're, right, just a commodity producer or a small-scale farmer, that you're either going to have these things or you're going to have business. But it sounds like you're trying to make sure that they're running it like a business.
Well, make no mistake, I totally believe that this is a great lifestyle. I mean, I've been milking cows, gutting chickens, and planting seeds for 12 years now, and I still do it all the time. So this is a great lifestyle, and that's the reason I chose this. But you have one of two choices, Roger, when you adopt this lifestyle. If somebody's going to leave a job and go out and start a farm, you have one of two choices. You either will have to subsidize your farm, and I'm not talking about the way the big commodity people do it. I'm talking about you subsidize it with an off-farm job. Or you have to make sure that farm produces the income that your family needs to be financially sustainable. And there's a lot of talk about sustainability in agriculture, but let's start with financial. If you're not financially sustainable, if you don't have enough customers coming in, and if you're not making enough profit on the products you're producing, it doesn't matter how biodynamically sustainable you are. You're not going to be around any longer. So my basic point is, the first course I have actually in the Small Farm Nation Academy is all about the farm business mindset, and it challenges people to do an assessment of, are they running a hobby or are they running a business? If you're running a business, it doesn't matter if it's farming or high tech or dental practice or a lawyer or anything else. Farming starts with marketing and getting customers for your practice, and then being able to get enough revenue from those customers to make an attractive profit margin.
Tim, I would imagine when people are at the brink of making these decisions, oftentimes they may have a partnership. They've got a spouse, perhaps, or best friend or something. And one or the other of them may have to keep a job in the city or keep another a side job while they're ramping up. Is that often the case?
It's very often the case. It's a funny thing, and this is a controversial statement that I'm going to make, and so I'm going to probably immediately retract it. But I wrote a post last year about the 10 or 11 business rules for starting a farm business. And one of the rules that I wrote in there was to quit your day job and walk away from it and commit yourself to the farm. And it's a controversial, I think, comment, because so many people will give the opposite advice. They'll basically say, well, make sure you keep your job until it's financially viable, and you know, then you can quit and do it. You have to understand that I'm an entrepreneur by background, so I quit a Fortune 500 company, 20 years ago and started my own business before I started a farm. And what I learned that works for me is burning the bridges behind me. Because if I have a leg back in a safe day job, it's always calling to me, like, there's healthcare, there's a good benefits, it's a clean working environment, there's a paycheck every week, and all those kind of things. But to answer your question, yes, it's common that people keep an off-farm job, whether it be for the benefits or the income, while they struggle to get their farm business going.
Well, and it might be one or the other of them, and maybe their goal is that both of them will be out in a certain number of cases. Do you advise people to make like a five-year plan to set goals for, this is where I want to be in 2 years, this is where I want to be in 5 years?
Well, the first part of the planning process that I do is actually, again, in that first course, the farm business mindset. I offer a one-page farm business plan that walks them through 8 points. And what I'm really trying to get them to understand is to make a decision about what their key competitive advantage is going to be right from the start. Where are they going to make their money, and how is that going to be defensible? Now, after they do that and we go through the different courses and lessons, and they get further into developing their brand and they start thinking about how to build their email list and how to go to market, what their go-to-market choices are, yes, one of the things we talk about is developing a 3 or 5 year, not plan, Roger, but vision. I want them to visualize what they want their life to look like at some point down the road, 3 years, 5 years, or whatever. And that vision will translate back into what their branding strategy is, mm-hmm. How they want to be seen by the public, how they really want to be in terms of a product enterprise and in terms of a financial enterprise. And then that weaves its way back into their actual business planning. But I'd rather people visualize clearly what it is that they want to be. If you get too mired down into planning, I'm going to do this typical business plan template that you see all over the place. Look, I know from experience, with venture capitalists and raising money and running businesses, people do those plans once, put them in a desk drawer or in a filing cabinet, and they never see it again. So I started with a one-page business plan for their farm in the academy, get them to understand what their advantage is going to be, and then I start walking them through the different tactics they have to do to build their brand to be successful.
Tim, tell me again about your transition. When you were fed up with what you were doing and decided to leave the rat race, as successful it was in the terms that most people look at, when was a light bulb go off and say, okay, this is it, I'm out of here, and this is what I want to do?
I think a lot of people had this light bulb moment around the same time that I did, because this is back around the Omnivore's Dilemma time and Michael Pollan, and it's when Joel Salatin started to become a figure. But I had actually decided to leave corporate America right before I even heard of those guys. And, the light bulb moment for us, it's going to sound simple, Roger, but it was just that we became aware of how unaware we were of where our food came from. It was just like a light bulb went off, like, wait a minute, where does our food come from? How do things work? And when my wife and I reached that realization, given my entrepreneurial background, which means that I'm kind of fearless and willing to go try anything, rather than do the sensible thing, which is just go to a farmer's market and find out where your food comes from and buy it from farmers, no, what we decided to do was I bought 126 acres 3 hours away and went out and we built a farm from scratch, even though we had never farmed before. And we started with a herd of Murray Gray cattle doing grass-fed beef, and we raised Ossabaw Island and large black and Berkshire pigs in the woods, and we raised, you know, thousands and thousands of meat chickens a year, processed the chickens on farm ourselves. We later started milking Jersey cows, milked 24 Jersey cows, started making cheese, got pretty good at it, started winning a lot of awards with that, and, you know, just started building a completely integrated, sustainable livestock farm, you know, that we loved. And we would never go back to that rat race. But once we made that choice, then we started learning about Michael Pollan and Joel Salatin, and these people were even more inspirational, you know, to give us ideas and inspiration to keep doing what we were doing.
You know, and after you made that transition, you were living a life, and you were living a life that many people envy and would like to figure out how they follow in your footsteps. And why did you decide that you should also add kind of this new business, in a way, of training farmers to do the same thing that you've gone through?
Let me talk about this in two ways, if I can. The first part, that people envy this lifestyle. You know, one of the sad things that I get sad about is that so many people do want this lifestyle, but they, let's face it, a lot of parts of this lifestyle cost money. So you either have to go apprentice with farms and live on their land, or live in a, you know, you get a small camper or a mobile home or whatever and lease land the way Greg Judy did in building his big farming operation. Or you have to do what we did, which is earn money in another lifestyle and then basically trade all your values. Trade, you know, shopping at stores for shopping at Goodwill. Trade shopping, going out to restaurants for cooking at home. And you just change all your values, which is what we did to how we're able to afford this. But as we became immersed in this lifestyle, I became passionate about two things. One is small-scale sustainable farming, and the second is cultivating local food cultures. Now, you mentioned Belgium a few minutes ago and how some of the farming practices are different in other locations. I've done some travel, been fortunate to go to places like Provence, where you actually see real food cultures, where they're eating local cheeses, and when you go to the farmers markets in Provence, you're seeing charcuterie and meat actually hang there, which our USDA here would hate, but it's hanging there in the open air. And I'd love to see that happen. Now, you started this episode talking about how, you know, there's commodity farming and there were legislation a few decades ago to encourage that. Well, one of the things that we need to do is get consumers to recognize that they have choices. The only choice is not big supermarkets and commodity agriculture, although that's a fine choice for many people. There's also a choice of local, small-scale farming. So I wanted to start some kind of practice that would bring those two together. And what I realized, Roger, is if I can be helpful at all to small family farmers at allowing them to be more effective at marketing what they do and getting customers, then I accomplish both of my objectives. They will be more successful and therefore more financially sustainable, and they will reach more customers, which accomplishes my vision of trying to help build local food communities.
Well, I like what you say, Tim, and I feel very, very similar about how all of this area you're describing and the opportunity. But could you give us an example of somebody that came to you and got engaged in the training programs and where they were then and where they are now?
Yeah, I'll give you a real-life example. In fact, they don't know I'm going to mention them because I didn't know you were going to ask this question, but they'll be fine with it because they're so successful. But I started, before I started the academy, I started by doing lots of training in person with farm schools, and I would have people from all over the country that would come to these farm schools, whether they had started a farm yet or not started a farm. And I'm really proud of one couple that originally was from New York. And he was an investment banker. She was in fashion design. And they wanted to go start a farm. Originally, they wanted to start a dairy operation and make it a cheese business. And then they came to my farm school. I've been in touch with them many times since that farm school. They started a farm in Tennessee called Little Seed Farm. They ended up having to change from a cheese business to a soap business because of some capital and regulatory issues. But they have an incredible business now, 9 years later after we first met, doing artisan soap from goat's milk. It's at littleseedfarm.com. It's an amazing story. They've cultivated a big following. They're sold, you know, coast to coast and a lot of the big stores. And there's a lot of farms out there that can replicate what they've done. Now, Roger, I want to be clear. I take no credit for their success. They are very good marketers, very good business people. But a lot of the farmers that I talk to come from these kind of worlds where they have professional skills, but they lack the marketing skills or the marketing vision.
How far afield are farmers coming that are connecting with you?
Well, first, in my academy today, they're from Australia to Europe, and of course, mainly America, but they're all over the world in the English-speaking countries. But back when I did my farm schools, they came to Georgia from Washington State, from New York, New England, from Texas, from Wisconsin, from all over. And there's many farms that came to those farm schools that are now running grass-fed beef farms in Missouri, or they're running artisan cheese businesses in Wisconsin, or any, you know, of those other states, they're running something. And there's also many, Roger, who came that aren't doing anything, that they came and they went to the academy or the farm school and they learned, you know what, this isn't for me. So I think that was actually the most, you know, cost-effective lesson they could have learned, is like, this isn't the life I want now that I see what it's really like.
How hard is it to do a kind of one-size-fits-all when the geography is so different and the situations are so different across the country?
Well, it's actually pretty easy. You start with answering the key questions of the business plan, not the document that everybody's familiar with, all the 30-page business plan, but the one-page business plan that I walk them through, because it forces them, when they answer those questions of what am I going to sell, to whom am I going to sell it, how am I going to get my competitive uniqueness that's going to sustain premium prices. So you take the Kansas example, that's a long ways away from a market. Roger, how's that any different than what I did in Northeast Georgia? We started a farming practice raising meat sustainably, but no one in our community wanted to buy from us. We created a market in Atlanta, which was 2.5 hours away, and in Athens, Georgia, which was 1 hour and 15 minutes away. So we did retail cuts. We had walk-in freezers on our farm, and then we delivered on a weekly or every other week basis to several drop points in those markets, and we cultivated, you know, that customer base. Anybody can do that. If you're 2 hours from a place, or 3 hours from a place, then you have to do that. Now, the example of Little Seed Farm, sure, they're lucky that they're close to Nashville, but they don't get too much of their business from there. They created a product that is non-perishable. So soap can actually be shipped and sold to a number of markets. So when you're starting your farm enterprise, you'll have to think about, well, am I going to do raw milk, which is highly perishable, and how am I going to transport that? Or am I going to do something like a farm craft or fiber or soap or charcuterie or whatever it may be? It starts with the planning, and that planning means assessing where you're located vis-a-vis the markets that you're going to sell to.
One thing I wonder about when you talk about small-scale farming, for example, is, you know, where's that limit? I mean, is there a ceiling that, okay, you no longer get to call yourself a small farmer? I mean, is there a point where your business is so successful, you open up, you know, other operations or other farms, and you've all of a sudden got 25 or 30 employees, and your distribution is broad, and you have to say, okay, you graduate. You know, you no longer get to call yourself a small farmer because you've just kept growing and growing and growing and gotten large. I know this is kind of a weird question, but scale is so much a part of how we identify this movement. And I'm just wondering that people don't have to be, you know, worried about the fact that they kind of get pushed out. I no longer get to call myself a small farmer.
Yeah, you know, I think the way to answer that from my point of view is not so much what the size is, but to divide the world into two types of farms. There's commodity farms and there's non-commodity farms. Commodity farms are those that grow and they sell through an existing system, a middleman, that's going to then put that product out into the world, whether it be into distributors, grocery stores, or to other countries. The non-commodity farms, no matter how big they are, create their own markets. So let me give you an example. We all know what a small farm is. I mean, a small farm can be somebody that's working an off-farm job. They got a few chickens. They're selling some eggs. That's on one end of the small-scale farm continuum. Now, in the Small Farm Nation Academy, another one of the things that we do, Roger, is I do these monthly mastermind interviews where I'll do a video call with somebody that can help my audience be more successful. So one of my favorite farmers, and I did a mastermind with him a few months ago, was Will Harris from White Oak Pastures in Georgia. Now, Will was a conventional cattle farmer. For decades, his family was, up until the mid-90s. They sprayed chemicals on their pasture and fed all kinds of grain only to their cows and then shipped them off to feedlots. He had an awakening in the late 90s and became committed to organic agriculture. And he still runs the largest organic farm in Georgia today. He's got, you know, a couple thousand acres that he's farming. He does $30 million a year in business as of right now. He now does pastured poultry, and he created an on-farm poultry processing plant. He still does tons and tons of beef, and he's got his on-farm red meat processing facility. He does sheep for lamb. He does pork. He does all these things. It's just a matter of time before he does cheese as well. So I wouldn't call $30 million a year business small at all. Yet what Will has done is he has cultivated a market for his products. Now, his products are available in grocery stores, but he also sells directly to consumers online via his store and via his farm store. And he has over 100 employees. So while he's not a small business by the classic definition of the word, his business behaves like a small business because he's responsible for his own branding, his own customer acquisition, his own pricing, and all the things that most commodity farmers are not responsible for.
You know, Tim, that is a great answer. I have people ought to play this podcast back and repeat that again, because I think you described something that's a dilemma for some people, to think of it how they think of it differently and how they think of the size and how important that is. When you differentiate, as you did, an identified commodity, then I'm thinking about almost like branding what isn't commodity. Because I understand, I think there's a place right for commodity agriculture. It's necessary. It is more industrialized processes. But it has a role to play and a contribution to make. But you're talking about more specialized, or what used to be called niche, N-I-C-H-E, spots, or artisan, the non-commodity. What do you like to call it?
Well, this is a little tricky because most of us in this world call it sustainable farming. I love that for what my views are on it, but I don't like the opposite of what it means. I'm not trying to imply by saying that to somebody who's doing large commodity farming that their way of farming isn't sustainable. And the reason I don't like to draw that line, Roger, is because it's so divisive. We pit each other against one another. What I like is for consumers to have choices. If people want the cheapest chicken from Walmart, then they should be entitled to make that choice. I don't have any problem with that. If somebody wants to buy raw milk from a local farmer who is doing that because they think raw milk is the most nutritious product available for their family and they want to share it with their community, then I think consumers should have a right to choose that as well. What I really have come to grips with is the biggest challenge I feel that most, not everybody, but most small farmers are faced with, the ones that are trying to direct market, is they're struggling with the marketing skills. The ones who aren't struggling with the marketing skills, they're doing great and they're knocking it out of the park. And some people are inherently or just innately great marketers, but most people really struggle with, how do I build my brand? What do I put on my website? What do I say? Is it important what I write? How do I build an email list? When I have an email list, what do I communicate in my email list? What do I do on social media? How do I choose which way to go to market? Should I go to farmers market? Should I do a metropolitan buying club? Should I do a CSA? Should I sell to distributors? Should I sell to restaurants? But, oh my goodness, I'm afraid to pitch a restaurant. How do I overcome my fear of talking to chefs? It's all these kind of things that I hear over and over again in the academy that I try to be there to serve my audience and help people with.
Well, the thing I was wondering about, from the time that you left the job and started farming yourself, you've been watching this. You've either been involved in doing this all yourself or training other people, and now you've got the academy. What have you seen that's changed? Are you seeing a trend?
When we started, we, of course, opted out of the rat race to go out to the country to grow food, and that was kind of a novel story at the time. It is absolutely not a novel story anymore. you know, you go, but yet you go to so many farm websites and people talk about how, well, here's what we're trying to do. We're trying to go back to the land and do this. That's not enough anymore. It was enough to get us some notoriety when we started. One thing I've noticed is that to be successful with farming, direct market farming today, requires more business chops, I'll call it. It wasn't the case 10 years ago when Michael Pollan was writing all of his books and when Joel Salatin was on every movie that hit the big screen and people were coming and just enthused about sustainable farming. That dries up a little bit. You still have a lot of those supporters, but it's much more important today, and the onus is on the farmers to cultivate that market for two reasons. One is there's not as much talk out there about it in the media anymore because it's a little bit old. And the second is there's been more people drawn into the farming world that want to start their own farm. So you have friendly competition out there. And don't fool yourself into thinking that you don't have competitors. Of course you have competitors out there, whether it's another farm or whether it's a new entrant like CrowdCow or Blue Apron, or whether it's, you know, traditional stores like Whole Foods or Publix or Safeway or whatever. There's all kinds of alternatives out there. So if a farmer's going to be successful, they have got to have the marketing chops to be able to cultivate a following.
Well, now, Tim, let's look ahead. You were describing what's happened so far, how it's changed to date. And if you're going to look ahead now over this next 5 years, what do you expect to see different? I mean, how do you think this trend is going to be going over the few years that are in front of us now?
It looks like we're going to have a continued acceleration of technology playing a role. I mean, if you look at what CrowdCow does, for example, it's a really interesting business model that didn't exist 5 or 10 years ago. And a lot of people really couldn't have seen what that was going to be like. So you're seeing a lot more people and investors get into this game of how do I connect consumers with naturally grown fruits and vegetables and meats. To me, Roger, if I'm a farmer, that's really exciting news because venture capitalists don't get involved with this unless they see the opportunity. And a lot of these are venture-funded enterprises that are starting to crop up. So I think we're going to continue to see that. Now, it creates an opportunity for the farms because one way that they'll always be able to differentiate against a Blue Apron or against a Whole Foods, you know, now Amazon or whatever, is that customer relationship, that transparency, the ability to get consumers to really feel like they know that person, or in the craft brewery metaphor, I know the person who brewed my beer. I know the person who grew this carrot or the person who raised this pig for me. So I believe farmers have to capitalize on that. But, you know, the technology is going to get more complicated and create more opportunities. And on the marketing side, the social media platforms are just going to continue to, you know, expand. And there's going to be something, there's going to be a new Facebook in 5 years that everybody's going to be confused about and think, oh, I need to go market on that and spend all day long being, you know, tied up on doing a post on Facebook rather than doing things that really matter in terms of building their farm.
Boy, Tim, these are great insights. And I think I would add to it, it's also good to keep surrounding yourself with people that have good insights and other people that believe in what you're doing and where you're headed. And you get the positive reinforcement, but you need to get support. And you're offering support for farmers. And if people want to get more information on the programs you're directly involved with, where do they find you?
They can just go to smallfarmnationacademy.com. That's my membership site if they want to join. Or if they're looking for free content, I have a, you know, blog and podcast, and I have free videos. Just go to my main website, which is smallfarmnation.com.
Well, great. I think you're going to have some people following up. And I know they all already are. You've got people all over the country that you're connecting with. It's an important journey that you're on. I really appreciate your taking the time to be with me on Farm to Table Talk today.
Roger, my pleasure. I love what you're doing. It's a real pleasure to be here.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.